Welcome to this sermon podcast from the Memorial Church on Emmanuel Road in Cambridge, England. The church website can be found at www.cambridgeunitarian.org. My name is Andrew James Brown, and I'm minister to this liberal congregation, and this is my sermon of the 12th of February 2012, called Time Scissored Work, The Meaningful Giftedness of Fragments. As always, the sermon here draws on my own faith and experience, and it is offered to the congregation and to you in this podcast, simply as an encouragement to further reflection and thought. It is most certainly not a definitive statement with which you must agree. As my 16th century Polish Socinian forebears said, "Whilst we declare our own opinions, we oppress no one. Let every person enjoy the freedom of their own judgment in religion. Only let it be permitted to us also to exhibit our view of divine things, without injuring and calumniating others." In this spirit, I bid you welcome. We often like to think that full meaning, that which is truly meaningful, can only come from something that is, in itself, complete. It's a belief that it is only a complete and finished story that can tell us the deep truths we need to live by. And underlying this idea is, of course, the belief that the real deep and finished story is a traditional monotheistic conception of God, the God who is beginning and end, Alpha and Omega. And in a sense, that's what I'm pushing against. In our culture, it should come as no surprise that the collection of stories, known as the Bible, has been believed to be complete, and so a trustworthy guide to the truth of how to live. It is, of course, intimately related with our conception of, our culture's conception of in what consists God. However, even the increasingly secular understanding of the Bible's texts that developed since the mid-19th century, with the rise of historical critical biblical studies, and in particular the influential search for the historical Jesus, we still maintain this hope, albeit in a different way. We began to think that, if only we could get better historical, archaeological, documentary, or theological and philosophical evidence, get back to the original words and their original meaning, fill in the gaps, and so know more of the complete story, we would slowly close in on the kind of truth we can really live by, or even decisively reject. In either case, this historical critical process would, we thought, itself bring us closer to the accessing and owning of the full meaning of the biblical texts. But after countless hours expended in scholarly, literary, philological, anthropological, archaeological, and of course theological pursuits, all we have really been able to do is confirm how fragmentary the texts are, and also how fragmentary remains our knowledge of the times, peoples, and events about which the Bible relates. The fragmentary nature of our texts and knowledge can, of course, be felt negatively, but I think that it's something positive which can ground our liberal attitude and practices, and which we should celebrate. Today's address tries to gesture towards this positive point, a point which showed up for me because Tuesday is Valentine's Day, the day upon which lovers or would-be lovers express their love to each other by exchanging gifts of various kinds. And I was minded to at least try and write an address connected with the theme of the day. As most of you will know, apart from the Bible, I tend to draw upon illustrations and inspiration from poets, but I have to say that, in general, love poetry is not my favourite literary genre. However, one poet, very famous across over 2 millennia for her love poetry, and whose work has continued to sustain, bewitch, and intrigue me throughout my literate years, is Sappho. And so to her I returned. Sappho was, as most of you will know, a Greek poet, born between 630 and 612 BC, and who died around 570 BC. Very little is known about her life, but we do know that her poetry was greatly admired throughout antiquity, and was placed upon the later Greeks' definitive list of 9 lyric poets. However, over the years, like many other ancient authors, nearly all of her poetry has been lost to us. Of the more than 500 poems that she wrote, Only about 2,000 lines which fit into intelligible fragments have survived. However, her reputation has continued to live vibrantly into her own age and culture, thanks to her recorded reputation in other authors' works, and to an oddity concerning the way that many of the fragments of her poetry that we do have actually survived. Although very few fragments of her poetry survived in Greece itself, in 1879, in an oasis in Egypt, a great deal of new material was discovered. In Egypt, as you might imagine, her poetry was written on papyri, and by coincidence, papyri were also used to make the papier-mâché used in wrapping mummies. In unwrapping the mummies discovered in this oasis, it turned out that Sappho's poetry, and of course much other work besides her own, provided the raw material for their wrappings. To make this papier-mâché, the papyri were torn into strips and, in consequence, as Willis Barnstone, one of Sappho's modern translators, puts it, "The mummy makers of Egypt transformed much of Sappho into columns of words, syllables or single letters, and so made her poems look, at least typographically, like Apollinaire's or E.E. Cummings' shaped poems. The miserable state of many of the texts has produced surprising qualities. So many words and phrases are elliptically connected in a montage structure that chance destruction has delivered pieces of strophes that breathe experimental verse. Her time-scissored work is not quite language poetry, but a more joyful cousin of the eternal avant-garde, which is always and ever new. So Sappho is ancient and, for 100 reasons, modern." And we saw in our readings how this time-scissored shaping has also directly inspired the work of a number of modern poets, like Ezra Pound and Robert Creeley. And I'd encourage you to look at the blog post where I put a number of these poems alongside two fragments of Sappho's own work. It becomes very obvious when you see it. And I included Creeley's very Sappho-esque poem Song, because I first pondered upon it during the summer I fell in love with Susanna, the woman who in 1996 became my wife. Anyway, today there is no doubt that Sappho's body of work, though fragmentary, forms one of our culture's great texts. Now, in relation to the greatness of texts, a few weeks back I cited the philosopher Ian Thompson, who said that what makes the great texts great is not that they continually offer the same eternal truths for each generation to discover, but rather that they remain deep enough, meaningful enough, to continue to generate new readings, even revolutionary re-readings, which radically reorientate the sense of the work that previously guided us. And what I want us to see today is that the greatness of Sappho's texts, their meaningful quality for our culture, stems, as you now know, not at all from their completeness, but precisely from their incompleteness. But when you really think about it, and here I arrive at the thing to which I really wish to draw your attention to today, what is obviously true of Sappho's texts also turns out to be true of even those great texts we think of as most complete and fixed, as some people have claimed and still claim the Bible is. But this belief that they are complete is clearly nonsense, for whenever we engage with these texts imaginatively rather than dogmatically, we find that the most complete of them is full of lacunae, gaps, where we find that as we begin to read, we suddenly find we have ourselves entered into the text and begun to inhabit it in a living way. We enter ourselves into the narrative, and we become part of the story. And in this encounter, the story changes us, and because of its depth, what the story tells us is also changed. In this encounter, we, it, and the world can suddenly start to show up differently, or disclose to us new things. Entering proactively into a living relationship like this with one of our culture's great texts, i.e. not passively approaching it as some fixed complete thing that we can examine, walk round, understand, or that we would bow down before, and which we believe will tell us what it all is all about. Entering proactively into a living relationship with one of our culture's great texts is somewhat like going hitchhiking. The philosopher Freya Matthews illustrates this nicely in her book Reinhabiting Reality, Towards the Recovery of Culture. In the quotation that follows, Matthews is not talking about texts, but our wider world, and I'll return to that thought in a moment. Suffice it to say here that texts are, of course, part of our world. Here's Freya Matthews' words. The modes of proactivity in question are those that work with rather than against the grain of the given. By this I mean there are forms of energetic flow and communicative influence already at play in the world. An agent, that's potentially you and me, an agent in this mode is a kind of metaphysical hitchhiker, catching a ride in a vehicle that is already bound for her destination. Or, more usually, via the hitchhiker's communicative engagement with the driver of the vehicle, both the hitchhiker's own plans and those of the driver are changed. The vehicle heads for a destination that neither the hitchhiker nor the driver had previously entertained, but which now seems more in accordance with their true will than either of their previous destinations. Now, this liberating and creative way of understanding what it is to be in the world is only possible because our greatest and culturally enduring texts are those which are open and, in the way I've outlined, incomplete and fragmentary. But this is not only true of our texts, but reality itself. Ian Thompson follows his note I cited earlier about great texts by expressing his wish to get even his first-year philosophy students to see that reality is itself perhaps the greatest of these great texts. And it seems to me that the abundant and meaningful life is had by being always prepared, as Jesus advised in our reading from the Gospel of John, chapter 6, verses 1 to 14. As Jesus advised, to gather up the fragments left over, so that nothing may be lost. The community gathered around Jesus that day, the 5,000, were fed by gathering up fragments in the first place, by asking all those present to contribute, and then by gathering up the abundant fragments left over from that encounter, enough to fill 12 baskets, and therefore sustain still more people for another day. It is a reminder that, as Jacques Maritain once said, things are not only what they are, they give more than they have. And this is why I always conclude our period of open conversation, which immediately follows the giving of this address, with some words by Sarah York. We receive fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight. Let us gather them up for the precious gifts that they are, and renewed by their grace, move boldly into the unknown. All this is a reminder that our culture's great texts are never given to us objectively as complete, finished things, with a fixed eternal meaning lying at their core, but only given to us through our involvement with them. And our involvement with them always changes the text, and always changes us, and we both end up at a destination that is sometimes a little, but sometimes also a great deal different from where we expected we were going. And more importantly than this, that reality itself, which includes all of us, is never given to us objectively as complete and finished, with a fixed eternal meaning lying at its core, but only given to us through our involvement with it. And this kind of proactive engagement is characterized by love. Not romantic love, but erotic love, the kind of love about which Sappho wrote. And by this I mean a deep, intimate, engaged, and literally touching love for our world, in which infinite fragments continually commingle and endlessly give birth to new, often unexpected, and deeply meaningful expressions of life.